Curbsider's Teach podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions.
Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the speakers and should not be interpreted to reflect the official policy or position of any entity. You should always do your homework and give us any feedback.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders Teach Season 4, our series on medical education. I'm Dr. Molly Hoyblein, joined by my co-host here in person at the Alliance for Academic Internal Medicine's AIM Week 24, Dr. Ira Krishnevskaya.
Hi, Molly.
On today's episode, we'll discuss responding to criticism or redirecting feedback as a medical education leader. Before we get started with that, Ira, will you remind the audience what we do on the show?
You got it, Molly. We are the health professions podcast for all things health professions education. We use expert interviews to bring you teaching pearls and practice-changing knowledge to inspire the next generation of clinician educators. We had a fantastic conversation with our guests, Drs. Dana Saul and Ali Dukoski. We cover various approaches for responding and considering modifying feedback as an educational leader.
Our amazing guests are Dr. Dana Saul. She is the program director for the Internal Medicine Residency Program at Honor Health in Scottsdale, Arizona. She has over 10 years of experience in both UME and GME and is passionate about all things medical education. And Dr. Ali Dukoski is a hospitalist clinician educator who currently serves as the medical director of UPMC Presbyterian Hospital Medicine. In addition to her operational leadership role with the hospitalist team, she directs the hospital medicine track of the UPMC General Medicine Academic Clinician Educator Scholars Fellowship and serves as the APD for quality and patient safety in the internal medicine residency program.
What a team. Well, we're excited to bring you this season of Curbsiders Teach with the support of and in partnership with the Alliance of Academic Internal Medicine. Woo, AIM. And a reminder that most episodes are available for CME credit through VCU Health CE for all health professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. Thank you to all our Patreon members. If you love the Curbsiders family content and haven't yet joined, please consider supporting us and continuing to create this amazing resource. So without further ado, let's get to it.
So Dr. Saul, thank you so much for joining us today. Are you okay if we call you Dana for this recording?
Of course. Thanks for having me.
So how's the conference been for you so far? What's been most exciting for you or most surprising for you that you've seen today?
Well, I always love a good AIM conference, and this one's not disappointing. It's nice to, I think, connect with old friends and colleagues that maybe you haven't seen for a while. And I attended the pre-course on remediation, so I learned a lot of important, tangible, you know, take-home points from that.
Can you give us some pearls, Dana, or even a pearl that was particularly shiny and bright?
Shiny and bright. I love it. So one of the speakers went over that there are really different frameworks or kind of workflows that you should follow when depending on what the deficit is. So if it's something like clinical reasoning or efficiency, maybe a pathway that involves a performance improvement plan and then thinking about remediation, whereas if it's a professionalism concern, really kind of sticking to that letter of deficiency and, you know, involving HR and things like that. So it was a nice way to separate that you might need a different approach for each type of resident.
I love that. Is there something that really surprised you about the remediation pre-course?
How many people struggle with it? It was like standing room only in there, and you just saw the nods and all the small group discussions. I think it's something that, you know, we as educators, it's common, you know, is something that continues to challenge even folks who have been in this role for a really long time.
And Dr. Dukoski, am I saying that correctly?
Mm-hmm.
Is it okay if we call you Ali?
Yes, that's.
Well, I would love to learn from kind of your experience at the conference and maybe a particular kind of highlight for you or pearl, as you know, Dana shared.
I agree. The energy here is different than other conferences we all go to as internists. I think my favorite part is seeing the rising chiefs. That's where the energy is most palpable. There's the groups of people who are seeing each other from lots of institutions. We're networking. We're seeing our old friends. And then there are the pockets of really excited new leaders coming up. It's the sweet spot of the learner level for me because it's just like fourth year med students. They're really smart. They're excited. They're ready to get to the next thing, and they want to hear everything they have to say because the stakes are high. The rising chiefs are in that bucket as well, and they're really ready and want to do a good job, and it's exciting to see.
We usually start our episodes of the case, but we thought maybe, you know, about our fictional hospital, but we can imagine there's also personal reasons why you all decided to really focus on kind of your particular topics at AIM, and would love to maybe have y'all share an anecdote or something that really kind of brought you to this topic of interest, and specifically responding to kind of maybe difficult to metabolize feedback or kind of how to make that a opportunity for both of you.
I don't know if it was one particular incident, but I will say at AIM last year, when I ran into Eric Worm, who was my co-presenter, we were just kind of sharing some of, in a commiseratory fashion, about how it feels when the residents and the faculty are angry at you over one thing over another. And as we were talking about it and how hard it is to deal with those emotions, we started talking about, gosh, everybody probably feels like this. We should share those feelings and let other people have a venue to kind of share them as well and maybe learn from each other. And so that's where, you know, the workshop came from. So it's not really necessarily one thing, but more a series of moments where I felt, ugh, this feedback is hard. And mm-hmm. what do I do next?
Mm-hmm. Allie, what about you?
Same.
I think same that this is all a shared experience, that the systems in which we function are very, very complicated, both from an educational structure. It's really important what we do. It's very important that we take care of them as humans and as learners and to become good physicians. The other side of that is, as leaders, it's really hard to know that people aren't going to be happy with everything that you do. I feel that emotion acutely. Thinking about merging quality improvement work and leadership and thinking about how do we solve problems? You solve problems by recognizing there are lots of different reasons why this problem came about. And it is important for future leaders, and as we teach our residents and our faculty, to understand that their complaint is probably rooted in a million different problems. And how do we teach the people coming to us with concerns to recognize that so we're not telling them that all the time? Well, it's not because of me. It's because of these other things. We don't want to sound like we're making excuses, but it's really challenging. I came into this role as an operational leader on the faculty side, not intentionally. It was something that came about a couple years ago, and recognizing how important being a systems thinker is, this workshop was born out of that, to make sure that we're teaching all those really important perspective taking and systems reasoning.
Great. Well, I think that's a good framing. I would say for me personally, you know, when I saw the topics of your case, it definitely brought up some memories of, you know, reading some of those feedback reviews that you get from the learners and just feeling like I put my all into it. Like, how is mm-hmm. this, you know, how is this not improved from last year? And like, it definitely creates that emotional response. And you both talked about kind of being aware of that emotional response and before being triggered by it, kind of taking some time to calm down before you respond. So Dana, we'll start with you. We aren't great about talking about emotion in medicine, and want to give a shout out to other professions or disciplines who maybe are doing a better job with this.
You know who you are.
But where did that acknowledgement of emotional valence come from for you?
Well, I think as, you know, as wellness has become this other pillar of residency training, and we expect it to foster it in our trainees, I think it's important to turn the cameras back on us and focus our attentions to program director wellness. And this is a big component of it. And so I don't know if it was any one profession, but it was a lot of looking to the literature, maybe a lot of the leadership literature outside medicine. You know, Brené Brown has some great stuff on leadership. We'll talk about the book Extreme Ownership, but, you know, just really a lot of leadership lessons from others that I think really focused on this notion of, in order to be a good leader, you have to be well yourself, and it's okay to have a bad day, and that's part of leadership, and you have to learn how to deal with that and lead through.
Mm-hmm. And Allie, do you have any tips around kind of the working through that immediate, maybe knee-jerk reaction that we often have and responding?
Yeah, it's interesting. I had never thought about it as a wellness piece. Yeah. I should have. I'm going to use that. Yeah, I actually think of it more, I talk about it more as role modeling, because if you can't demonstrate being even keeled, then you can't hope for anyone else to feel that way. So especially with chief residents and their very near peers who they're now managing, if they're mad all the time, it's hard for them to lead, and it's not a great example to set. So that's the way I usually think about it. But the wellness is very important. If you walk around upset all the time and angry that you are being challenged, I don't like this, why did you do it this way, you won't get very far. So I think that finding and knowing yourself is the way I talk about it. Where is who is your circle? Where are you venting? What is your outlet before you make any decisions? It's oxygen mask on yourself before others. Yes.
Yeah, that's one of our early slides, as we talk about, you know, between there's a space between stimulus and response, and there's power in that space. And I think part of that is to deal with your own emotions and come up with, you know, let it settle, and then come up with some concrete plans for action.
Mm-hmm. And having the patience to recognize it will still be there when you've come through it. That was the hardest thing for me. I'm like, they're expecting me to answer this. And then I realize, yes, they are, but tomorrow's okay, or even the next day.
Amazing. So after we've kind of taken that time, or as we're taking that time, Dana, you framed thinking about this emotional response by reminding us that we encourage our learners to view constructive feedback with a growth mindset. And I think it's a great reminder of how hard that is in practice when we're actually the ones trying to do it ourselves. We've had an episode earlier on the podcast around growth mindset in medical education with Dr. Nora Osman. But for those of us listeners who may not be familiar, could you briefly explain how the growth mindset could help you respond to critical feedback?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, we ask our learners to accept feedback and use that to help them grow. We tell them we don't expect you to be perfect and fully baked. Otherwise, why would you be in training? And yet, it's so hard to apply some of those lessons to ourselves as leaders. And so looking at this leadership through this lens of, I'm going to make some mistakes along the way, and I'm going to learn from those mistakes. I'm going to find maybe where my deficits are, and what skills I need, and then work to build those skills and iterate, you know, my own competence over time. You know, can really help foster that growth in leaders. But it's hard because we feel this pressure. We've now risen through the ranks, and we feel this pressure to be perfect all the time, just like I'm sure our residents do. And so we spent some time at our workshop really talking about the shame sometimes that comes from when you feel like you're failing to meet expectations, and how to really, in a meta way, look at it from a, okay, this is just a skill that I don't have yet, or a task I haven't succeeded in yet, but there's, you know, I have the tools to be able to do this.
I feel, Daniel, like you're speaking to my core, because as a recovering perfectionist, I have a lot of issues with that, or like it is something that I'm working on. And I also love that you pointed out like the power in each of these situations, like in opportunity, there is power in that space between something happening and your response. There is power. And like in acknowledging that you are not fully developed yet, there is also power. It's like a space of, I don't know, opportunity and a chance to say like, oh, there's a fuller, more vibrant, more kind of, I don't know, vulnerable maybe even version of me. And I think that like as leaders, sometimes we forget to acknowledge that, like we aren't fully baked yet.
Oh, 100%. And I think kind of, Allie, going to what you said about role modeling, I think my residents have heard me 100 times say, you know, I didn't get this quite right this time, you know, and I think that helps, first of all, foster a growth mindset for them in their own clinical training, but then also be that vulnerable leader who shows them that, you know, I might not get it right every time, but I'm committed to keeping on trying to get it right. And I think there's a lot of trust building that happens, but it's hard. I mean, these are things that I, as I'm saying right now, I have to like also say to myself in the mirror, you know, when I'm having one of those difficult moments. But it's kind of a constant rhetoric I have to say to myself.
Totally. And speaking of rhetoric, when you do name this for learners, let's say, or, you know, that you're trying to share vulnerabilities, or something that you say, and Allie, please jump in if there's some verbiage that you use too. Like, are you sitting there being like, I'm not perfect, y'all. Like, this is, you know, this is a work in progress.
Or, yes. And then I'll say something, and then my residents will be like, oh, growth mindset. You know, I've said it so many times. So we'll all say it together. It's not a particular phrase. It's just a, sorry, guys. my bad this time, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know that I use a particular word either. I think the state of it is that safety, the psychological safety. And you said it exactly right. We want to create that safety for those we lead, but don't give ourselves the permission to be unsafe. It's hard to feel safe in that environment because you feel you want them to have that. But where is the trust in those who are judging us to have us make those mistakes? You know, this isn't a typo in an email. Some of this stuff has really big impact and affects a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And it does take a while to adapt the mindset overall to say, creating that psychological safety, that culture of, I'm going to work through this with you and together. It takes a while to get there. I think there's a lot of safety in, or a lot of comfort in sharing those challenges with the group and say, let's figure this out together. But making sure, is it a representative democracy or, you know, I'm going to take input and then I'm going to make the decision or we're going to vote. That's where I come down to make sure that as many people are happy as possible. The idea that I'm saying this while feeling like I want everyone to be happy all the time is funny, actually, but I work on it a lot, as mm-hmm. as you mentioned.
And as we've worked into this space of growth mindset and trying to work past some of the emotion, Ali, your group had a really nice framework to kind of help depersonalize some of that a little bit and help break down that response a little more simply. Could you define what a systems thinker is? You mentioned that earlier, and explain why that's helpful with responding to difficult feedback.
Mm-hmm. Systems thinker is someone who recognizes the complexity in which we function. So recognizing that change is not unidirectional, effects are not unidirectional. So multiple things go into something that happens, multiple factors go into changes that we make. If you recognize that, you're not reducing things to something very simple. One thing I ban my team from saying to me is, why don't we just? That drives me crazy because if I could just do it, I would have done it already, right? So there has to be a recognition of that complexity. And that's just the broad way of saying systems work together. Everything is complex. We have our piece of the world that we need to make work for us for all the goals that we've set. And modeling that, being transparent about the challenges we face as leaders, as physicians, as people, dealing with our families, balancing all of the things that go into our wellness, that's really important. The frameworks that we talk about that we talked about in our workshop today are really about categorizing things that happen to remove the emotional time that you spend, if you can. Mm. Those are the no-brainers that are supported by policy. I don't need to think a lot about this. I already know what to do here. The acknowledgeable things like, maybe you have a point. Hmm. I didn't think about it that way, but let me look into it. And then the actionable that really become clear that I need to bring my people together, stakeholders together, and solve this problem.
And Ali, thank you for breaking it down like that into those kind of no-brainers, knowledge, actionable. Is there a way to maybe give us a quick example, whether, you know, for the chief residents or for us who want to apply this framework to maybe our own leadership positions and how we can kind of use it on a day-to-day basis?
I'll do the easiest one first. The no-brainers are the easy ones. So if you have a Jeopardy or sit call policy where it is the way it works in our residency that if you are on Jeopardy, you come in when called. If a resident says, my family's in town, I'm not coming in because it's Saturday and we've got tickets to a show. No, that's pretty straightforward. You got to come in. That this is not going to be something that will entertain a lot of back and forth complaining about on Monday. You were on Jeopardy, you got to come in. The acknowledgeable, that's a very broad category, and it really depends on the program and what the issue is. There are some people who feel very strongly about how we structure certain rotations. This is a good example that we use in our workshop about when ACGME removed the requirement for an ED rotation for medicine residents, our program chose to leave the ED rotation in place because we felt very strongly that that was an important experience. The residents said, I don't want to be in the ED because It's hard. It's a lot of weekends. It's a lot of nights. They were being made to go back and forth and really didn't see the value, probably because we didn't need to communicate the value of it. It was just, you got to do it. This mm-hmm. is part of your requirement. But having to then reframe, why is it important? Why is it educationally valuable? But also at the same time, adjusting the rotation to address their concerns. So it was acknowledgeable in that, I hear you. We're not going to remove it, but we will make these changes because you're right. If it's an elective rotation, you shouldn't have all these weekends and mm-hmm. you shouldn't have a bunch of nights. The actionable are more along the lines of program duty hour things or when a resident or faculty member is at risk. So you're worried that someone is taking a lot of sick calls, someone is acting erratically on the floors, attitudes have changed. What does that mean? Those are the kinds of things that if you hear about them or somebody's brings you a concern, you stop everything and bring in your, you know, you call the cavalry and you talk with your co-chiefs, you talk to your APDs or your program director.
And that's a tough role as chief resident to kind of, you know, having that triage framework helps a lot, but I'm sure there are places that fall in the middle of kind of knowing when and who to get involved. Yes. And you described the chief squeeze.
Yes. Yes.
Which sounds like the middle manager role that I think even as we move up into leadership as attendings, you're still in to some extent.
Completely.
How do you recommend chiefs and then the rest of us as we continue in our middle manager roles? Try to balance that, like how to think about when to pull in people, who do you tell after the fact, when do you consult beforehand?
Mm-hmm. As educators all in this room and likely people listening to this podcast, I would say expectation setting at the beginning as much as you possibly can. So what is your job description? What are your roles? And if you know or that you have a little bit of a spidey sense of this is a thing that could be in that weird category, ask, is this particular thing something you'd want me to bring to you, PD? Is this what you want to hear about? I would say chiefs are not likely going to have that insight to ask that at the beginning. So program directors and APDs who work with the chiefs need to be as explicit as possible. As like, here are the things that really get me. Here are the things I really need to be involved in because we have a tenuous relationship with the ICU faculty right now. Or this has been a problem at nights because our call rooms, they're too far away from the floors, whatever those things are that are sensitive topics. For faculty, it absolutely is something that you need to talk about as you're taking on new roles, as you're thinking about where are your parameters and who do you answer to, not just on the hierarchy and the org chart, but who are the people around you who have to be okay with what you're doing. And then ask. I think it is a really hard struggle, and we said this to the group today. We don't want to convey that you're hamstrung all the time by asking, but really being conscious that if the stakes are high, if it involves program decisions, if it involves interactions with other services in the hospital, and if it involves a resident at risk, you must consult first and don't inform later. And that's the balance. And it takes a long time to figure that out. I regret that these chiefs are only chiefs a year because it really takes a while to figure it out.
Well, I have to say, Allie, as a chief many, many years ago, yeah. I feel sometimes that I'm still in the squeeze.
Yes.
I feel like what you just said was really powerful, which is that as we take on new educational roles, the asking the things that you wouldn't know, like you don't know what you don't know. And so if you can get a sense from somebody who is, let's say, in a different level of the hierarchy or kind of maybe even your supervisor, like, what would you want me to call you for, mm-hmm. you know, like as an APD, you know, doing that to my PD or kind of whoever it is, I find that that question doesn't happen often enough. And I just appreciate you naming it.
We do that on the floors, right? We say, you're attending this week. Here are the things I really need to hear about because I care about it or because I know I need to support you. But we need to ask for that in our non-clinical work, too.
It's just like a senior resident, a new senior resident who isn't sure how the patient's doing and, you know, wants to just double check. It's like we need to be sensitive for these things, maybe not specific, and that's okay. And then I think it's a really good moment of learning for either the chief resident or maybe an early faculty member who says if they bring something to you that maybe they didn't need to or maybe they did, and then they can run their plan by you. Oh, this is what I heard. You know, here's kind of what I think about it. And this is what I'm going to do. Then it's a good moment to say, oh, yeah, that sounds like a great plan, and reinforce it, or to say, like, well, you might not be aware of X, Y, and Z, and so let's tweak it a little bit. So it's almost like good real-time feedback, too. So I never get upset when someone wants to run something by me. But I think the key, you know, I, in an effort to support them, I think have been quick to just give my solution, especially to my chief residents. And I'm kind of learning to say, great, thank you for bringing that to my attention. What are your thoughts? What should we do here? Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Get you employing the
development for myself too.
One minute preceptor and snaps frameworks. Well, speaking of managers, Dana, I feel like your group also presented a kind of, we'll say, quote about managers, which was, we must think less like managers and more like biologists. And I wonder if you can speak a little bit to that around kind of the seasons of change and how maybe that influences responding to certain difficult feedback and conversations.
Yeah, so we kind of talked about how, especially for the residents, it's a finite period of time for them. And so when they come to you with a problem that needs to get solved, it is challenging because as folks who have been in their positions for a while or at an institution for a while, you know that things take longer often to get right than the 3 years that the resident's there. And so, you know, we talked about this quote that, you know, a manager might be very task focused or band-aid focused, whereas we need to be able to kind of see the seasons of change of our programs and that our program 5 years from now won't look like what it did 5 years before, and it won't look like 5 years even further in the future. And being able to kind of communicate that all good things take time and we're here for the journey, really.
The evolution.
Yeah. Really.
I love that. Yeah. I love that.
And you also bring up this concept of extreme ownership as a leader and how it can help you move past a critical reaction from your learners or your team. Can you tell us more about that?
Sure. So extreme ownership, I highly recommend listening to this book. It was written by two Navy SEALs, Jocko Willink and Leif Babin. And it's really about leadership lessons they learned as part of the SEALs team. And they introduce extreme ownership really as this concept that came from when they were involved in a very intense conflict, only to find out later that part of that conflict was blue on blue, meaning the same side fighting each other. Mm. And so that's led to a really big debrief where they learned that one of their subordinates, you know, had kind of helped lead to the conflict. And so when they were debriefing and deciding how can we prevent this in the future, this idea came that though they weren't the ones making the call in that exact moment, as captains of the ship, they were responsible for the training and execution of all things under their watch. And so I think from a program director perspective, or program leadership, there's a lot of things that go on in our programs that might not be directly related to us. Maybe there's a faculty and resident interaction that doesn't go so well, or a resident doesn't match into a fellowship that they were really hoping for. But this lens of ownership really puts you in this position to say, I'm going to own the outcome of what just happened. Maybe I'm not preparing my residents for fellowship. Maybe I'm not seeking out the right research opportunities and building those bridges with our research faculty. Or maybe I'm not coaching my faculty on what to do when they have a disagreement with the resident. So taking responsibility again for this outcome. And what's really great about doing that is it can be really disarming for your faculty and residents because they see you, instead of it becoming this blame game, it becomes you saying, hey, like, we didn't get this right. I have a role here. And then it puts you on their team to start thinking about how we can change things.
I love that. Allie, do you have any thoughts? I feel like I saw you nodding over there.
I'm just thinking it's a radical description of recognition that there's not one reason something happens. It's not because one person did something wrong and you blame them. It's about the system or the climate that was created, and the outcome is important. And how are we going to modify multiple things to prevent it from happening again?
Right. And we talked about how if it's the team, you know, of course we all work on the team, but again, as the captain, did I assign this project in a way that really didn't play to their strengths, or did I not give them enough time to actually execute this in a way that enabled us to be successful? So it just is a different lens, and I think something that, you know, helps already enable you for action, as opposed to, well, what? Who did this? What, you know, what was the circumstance?
Yeah, yeah, it's an RCA for a for the patient safety lens. It's we got to look at all the things that happened so it doesn't happen again.
Yeah.
Well, there's a few more things that you talk about, Dan, I feel like are really powerful, and maybe you could, you know, pick a few to share with our listeners. You know, radical transparency, self-determination theory, which we're all obsessed with in terms of learner autonomy, and then also co-production. And maybe could you share how these and potentially the extreme ownership intersect and how they kind of help us maybe improve our responses to challenging kind of feedback and difficult conversations?
Sure. So I think maybe I'll talk about the intersection of ownership and then using radical transparency. So radical transparency is just showing the end users, so our residents and faculty, kind of the inner workings of our system, the why behind all the decisions that we make. And an example that we shared in our workshop, and this was from my time in a different role, where we had a procedural complication that one of our residents performed. And from an ownership standpoint, we really realized that, you know, the see one, do one, teach one model is really not effective. And we did not set our resident up for success to be able to safely do that procedure. And so we really rethought how we were going to teach procedures, how we were going to assess procedural competency, how we were going to assess maintenance of competency. And we also, at the same time, kind of tested the residents on their procedural competency at different standpoints throughout the year. And what unsurprisingly we found is even after they were really trained up, skill decayed over time. And so we were able to show them this data to say, look, you think you're ready to do a procedure, but are you and your patient safe when we are showing you that, you know, your skill decayed over time? And it was a kind of like a light bulb moment for a lot of people. They didn't want to put themselves or their patients in that position. So it's kind of this radical transparency. As far as some of the other, you know, theories that you talked about, I think, you know, kind of the key to self-determination theory or co-production is really anytime that there's a problem, if you only do a top-down approach, nobody's going to be engaged in what you do. And sometimes you have to do that if there's like a patient safety issue, like the procedural thing. Sometimes you have to put a quick Band-Aid on. But what really makes for more successful change innovations is when you can get your residents and your faculty to produce them with you from the beginning and hear their feedback. I mean, if it's not for the residents, like, I don't know what I'm doing here. So I don't want to build something that's not effective for them. So really kind of engaging residents and faculty from the ground up on, okay, if we have this deficit in our program, so if our residents aren't doing well in the fellowship match or they don't have research, well, what should that look like? What kinds of mentorship do we need? Mm-hmm. What kinds of rotation should we offer? How should we integrate away rotations into our curriculum? All things that I think no one program leader can know and do alone. So you have to get that input and really expertise from the end users.
It's funny you bring up the fellowship question, because that came up in our program that we had an excellent match. And the third year still felt that they wanted more from the program to help support them. So even if there's not a problem, the users, the folks on the team, their engagement and belief in how successful things are really do matter, which is hard to quantify as somebody who's outcomes driven, right? Really, do we need to work on that? Everybody was fine, but it was important and it made a big difference, makes a big difference to the climate of the whole group to understand that program leadership is listening, even if the metrics that we use for success may be a little bit different from their metrics. They intersect.
I wonder, Ali, if we can roll with that example really quickly, only because I think that ties both of your presentations really well together in terms of someone says to you, like, I want more support on the fellowship badge. Oh. And you're like, wait, what? Like, we did great, you know? And it's kind of that moment where you're receiving that feedback and maybe your emotional response is like, are you joking me? Like, do you know how much time we put in? Do you know what we did to do this? So it's kind of that the valence comes up. I wonder if y'all can, like, maybe share if each of you were receiving that type of commentary. Sounds like you actually did. What would you do and how would you advise our listeners to respond knowing what we've talked about today?
I didn't hear about that at the time that the concern was raised. I learned about it after, as we were preparing cases for this workshop, of things that the current chief residents dealt with. I have this hybrid role because I run the hospitalist group. I also really work hard to recruit our third-year residents who want to be hospitalists. I want you to stay. So I did. I took it really personally when they said we didn't feel that we had enough support for job interviews and CV development. And I really had to step away. I was upset. Mm-hmm. But then I realized I thought that I had to walk a lot of people through things that I'm like, oh, wow, if I'm walking five different residents through the same thing, maybe we need to go upstream and say, let's help with CVs. Let's help with some of these other skills that you need to navigate this really complex thing that they have to do. And it's a shared experience. So fellowship and job search, whichever it is. And I think it's really hard to put your ego aside of how hard we do work and recognize no matter how hard you work, there are things to do better.
Yeah, and I think when you hear something like that and you know it maybe not to be true, then really kind of digging into what is the root of that issue. You know, is it that people didn't feel comfortable doing virtual interviews? Or is it that there was just too much chatter on the listservs and, you know, we needed to control the narrative a little bit more? So maybe getting to the root of the issue to know what to target. But then also, whether it's the annual program survey or one that we send out ourselves or the things that just come up de novo, we're getting a lot of things all the time that come on our radar that we need to improve. And so being able to, you know, kind of again in this co-production lens, being able to kick it back to the residents and say, okay, here are the couple things that we've identified. We need to triage all of our time because we can't do all of these things. And here's an instance where, you know, the feedback was maybe you weren't happy with this, but the objective evidence we have is that it went okay. Is this still something where you guys think we need to focus our energy, or should we maybe triage some of our time to these concerns that maybe we don't have as good outcomes on? So I think that's something that's been successful for me in the past.
I love that. And it sounds like also including your ownership of it. Like, this is something that we want for our residents to, you know, feel supported. And I take, you know, as a program leadership, take ownership in making sure that that's what happens upon graduation, you know?
I'd like to put another exclamation point on what you said about the feeling supported, because that's a trigger for me. When somebody says, I don't feel supported, it's a word we hear a lot. And we've heard it a lot with nurses on the floor. I don't feel supported here. As our hospital has really struggled with nursing, staffing, and high ratios, what digging into what do they mean by that? They don't mean that I'm not supportive of them, of course. They need this thing that we're not giving. And so I think that's a really important point, that if somebody says, I didn't feel supported, it's not necessarily the thing I think they mean, but what is that? What, digging into what they're really asking.
I will put an exclamation point to your exclamation point, Allie.
Sorry.
I do feel like I have learned the phrase, well, what does support look like to you, a million times this 1 year. Mm-hmm. I feel like I've said that so many times, and I've been like, did I just not say that phrase for the last, like, 8 years on faculty? Like, what is happening? But I do feel that there's more of a maybe openness for residents to say, like, this, I don't feel supported. And so then I've now defaulted to the question of, well, what would that look like? And it's been a growth edge, to get back to what we talked about earlier in terms of, like, educational leadership.
Yeah. So you don't say, well, me neither.
I don't. Yeah. Like, flip a chair and walk away. Yeah, exactly.
And Dina, you mentioned, like, you heard this feedback and you wished that you had heard it earlier. Do you have any tips about kind of creating psychological safety to reduce the hierarchy and allow learners and your team to feel like they can give you that feedback earlier, and that, you know, that there's a place to share that other than the yearly written survey where you're getting it, you know, 6 months after the fact? And
I think, I don't want to speak from a program director lens. I'll speak from a faculty leadership lens, because I'm not the one who would necessarily ever receive feedback from the residency until we're in APD meetings. I think I would always hear about that a little bit later than the PD maybe. But I think it is the back and forth and the sharing of uncertainty on my part to allow the safety of saying, I know it's not perfect. And here's what I usually start with. Here are the things that I see are the problem. What do you guys think? And so creating the space for them to agree or disagree or add. And I know there's a problem when there's silence. And I wait and hear, is this going to be a barrage of texts later? Or is everybody really happy? That can't be the answer.
Yeah.
And so then I'll find a couple of trusted people and say, is there chatter going on? They're like, no, you explained it. I'm like, oh, okay. Or there will be emails later saying I didn't feel comfortable, but here are the things. And this, the psychological safety is not a one and done thing. It's a constant recognition that transparency is important on both sides. Why do you feel this way? Here's how I'm going about making this decision. Here are the things that I need. Here's what I can't control. Sometimes for me, being honest about what I can't control at the very beginning has been the best, and say, but here's where I can control. We're going to make the best of this. And then we don't argue about those things that we're not able to control. One of the residents actually said to me, he had had a career in accounting or I don't know, what previous career before medicine, and said, I learned when I did this other job, what is the tone at the top? And the tone at the top is really important. I have it written on my board so I don't forget, because how we carry ourselves and create the inviting of the criticism and the inviting of the analysis of how we're doing will bode well, right? And if we're angry at and respond in a way that makes people say, I don't really want to bring that up again because that made her mad, or it's actually even people who don't want to personally upset me because I like you, I don't like this thing, and you are the same. You are our team. I'm like, no, I'm separate. And that's hard for me to have to separate myself from it, but it's a hard thing.
Yeah, for sure. I think my residents, if you're guys listening, I hope this is true.
Yeah.
I think we've really built a system where, you know, like, I know I can't do everything. I know I'm not always going to get it right, but I know that they know I have their backs, you know, that we've built a trusting relationship where they can, that they know I'm going to listen to them and at least hear their concerns in an authentic way where I don't act defensive or tell them no right away, but where they can actually kind of be safe to say whatever it is that's not working or troubling them. And we talked about in our workshop, we have this, you know, everybody loves a good 2x2 square, but we talk about this intersection between respect and permission. And you need to have enough mutual respect amongst your residents and faculty where they feel that they can bring up concerns and give them enough permission to be kind of change agents to really cross that innovation threshold. If people are too scared to tell you what's going on or what's a problem, you're never going to move the needle because you just don't know. You don't have a pulse on that. So, and I think that really starts with being able to authentically listen and not, you know, create the two problem. The first problem being you don't listen, and the second problem being the first problem they came in with in the first place. So, yeah.
Amazing. Well, you both gave your workshops today. Were there things that surprised you in the audience or questions that people had that really pushed you to think about this in a little bit different ways? And Allie, maybe we can start with you. Or
the rising chiefs in the room, I think it was all rising chiefs, they got there faster than in previous years, in that when we polled what would you do in this situation, they were very thoughtful in recognizing the other side and saying, well, I would really want to find out how the ED feels about staffing. What would happen to them if we pulled our residents from there? And I was like, wow, that was not what I expected the group to say. I think the level of nervousness or high stakes of their job was appropriately palpable in the room. I think they're nervous. And I think they appreciated hearing that some things you can give frameworks for and some things you just have to figure out. And a lot of it is your own emotional regulation. And then, and the last, the biggest thing is finding your people, finding the people who you can trust because you can't do it alone. And your job is to create a space where your team can come to you and you can be reasonable, but you can't do that if you're taking it on all on your own. So, yeah, I think it's a good group.
For us, we started our workshop by telling stories about times when the residents and faculty were mad at us. Mm-hmm. And then we kind of did a think, pair, share, where people were going to turn to the person next to them and, you know, discuss a time this happened to you and how did it make you feel. And usually when we do activities like this, you know, there's a little bit of lag time. Everyone turns to their partner. It's kind of quiet. They just start getting, they're not comfortable. They just start getting talking. It was like 0 to 60.
That is exactly what happened. Anger. Yeah. They're just like immediate noise. Yeah. Yes, it's great.
Yeah. It was, and you could just tell that people, this is clearly a topic that resonates with people. Everybody's felt this way. The noise level in the room was... But we had a hard time reeling them back in.
Yeah. You're like, I need a whistle.
Yeah, I know.
Like, how is this possible? That's amazing. I mean, I think that shows just like how generalizable this is and how this is something that we all experience in, you know, health professions, education in general. And just like we have to have a framework and an approach for when people are mad at us or when, you know, we're in tough feedback conversations. And I feel like y'all laid those out really well. Maybe we can wrap up with some take-home points. Maybe Dana, do you want to start us off?
Sure. I think, number one, it's okay to struggle in a leadership position. Here I am on this podcast, and I will tell you, I struggle with this every day. So it's a conscious decision about, you know, kind of getting meta about having a growth mindset, and I have to have a growth mindset about having a growth mindset.
We love meta on this podcast.
Yeah.
You know, this is great.
And growth mindset. So we're in perfect company. Yeah. So I think the big take-home points for me are listen authentically to your residents and faculty. If they're coming to you with a problem, that's actually a good thing because they feel safe being able to bring that up to you. And then it is normal to have emotions in that moment, but it's not personal, it's business. So being able to separate yourself from and let yourself feel the emotions, but then be able to move on from them and then use some of the frameworks that we talked about, like extreme ownership, co-production, to actually turn some of this angst into positive action.
I can't top that.
You don't have to.
I won't. All I will say is that the applying a systems outlook to how you then respond once you've pulled yourself out of that initial reaction, the visceral reaction of this is something I care a lot about and some people didn't like it or it's not going the way I hoped. It is comforting to continue to recognize it wasn't just me who did this. Even though I own it and I take responsibility for fixing it, there are many different areas of why did this come to be, and I do have the power or the agency to either change it or foster the change with the right people. I will echo, it's very hard. I struggle with it every day. I struggle with more and more or changing outlines of where autonomy is as a leader and can this be changed or who's going to look at this and say, no, you can't do it that way. Let's try it the other way. That's really hard. And making sure everyone in your sphere understands your constraints will help them help you more.
Amazing. Well, this was so helpful, so great. We do like to end with anything that you'd like to plug, any papers you have coming out, anything that you're excited to share. Or things you're working on. It could be feedback related or not.
We have some good DEI work on partnering with our LGBTQ communities and Indigenous communities. So it's in the just at our curriculum in the early stages of work. So I'm really excited to share more about that maybe at Next Aptum.
Oh, gosh. I will not share my own work, but my fellows. So we have GenMed fellows in our Clinician Educator Scholars program and a relatively new hospitalist track of that. And they are doing, both fellows are doing similar work with third years on psychological safety, which we've done some focus groups on. How do third years feel about being graded? Mm. And talk about psychological, you know, the stakes of them feeling like I want to learn and make mistakes, but I'm being graded all the time. That's hard. And then that's Dylan Yang's project. And then Justin Wang is doing a study on how third years study for the shelves and their safety. Yeah. And I don't like class. I want to do Anki and all those things that all the flashcards. So I think that we are talking a lot about creating safety in lots of different spaces. And I really love that you're highlighting
safety in a leadership space, because we've not talked about it before. So,
well, thanks to y'all. That was really easy to highlight. Thank you all so much.
Thank you for taking the time. This was great to sit down.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah. That was so fun to sit down in person and talk about receiving criticism or negative feedback. I know you hate it when I say that.
We're laughing because Molly knows how I feel about the words negative feedback.
Constructive.
There we go. Modifying. Yes, all the things.
But I feel like we covered so much and just really nice frameworks to kind of think about how to move forward when you're feeling that. And I love some of these theories about trying to think as a systems thinker, trying to have extreme ownership as a leader, trying to be able to use some of these theories from outside of medicine to move forward when you're trying to enact change and bring your team along with you.
Totally agree with you, Molly. I feel like it's like the same things that I'm sometimes reminding myself about. So maybe I need to have a little bit of compassion and patience with myself, but just being open to the growth that comes with kind of receiving difficult to metabolize feedback and being able to say, you know, I take a part of this and I will take a step back and let my kind of recognition of emotions happen too, so that I don't react, but I respond in a place of just listening and open and curiosity and acknowledging that we're all human and that we're all working on this. What an episode.
This has been another episode of our Curbsiders series, The Curbsiders Teach. Get your show notes at thecurbsiders.com/teach. A special thanks to the Alliance for Academic Internal Medicine for helping make this season possible, and thanks to Dr. Matt Watto and Paul Williams for their support in this project. Thanks to PodPaste for editing and production support. Until next time, I've been Dr. Molly Hoyblein.
And we're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge. And to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review our show on Apple Podcasts or contact us at thecurbsidersteach@gmail.com. A reminder that this and most episodes are available for CME credit for all healthcare professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. All you have to do is create an account. And I've been Ira Krasnovska, and thank you so much for joining us today and letting us bring you a little nugget of medical edutainment.
Yummy.